Well, what a wonderful, wonderful book House is.
And, thank you.
At first, I didn't think that I was going to like House as much as The Soul of a New Machine, because House seemed so much less important. As a computer buff, you know, I was interested in the computers and everything, but it didn't turn out to be that way at all. And in many respects, I like House even better, because the fact that there are people in there who are not unlike myself, who are trying to do something that I myself might want to do.
I felt like, also, I felt like I'm, you know, you like to feel that you're getting somewhere, you know. I feel that, at least in my research, and somehow I prepared for this book and prepared the people for it, that I was able to get a little deeper than I was with those with the engineers. Also, I just like it better, I guess, because it's the latest thing I've written. But somehow, I do have a funny feeling about this book where usually I hate everything I've written by this time I've turned it over, you know. And this one I still like. So, I mean, there's still passages I can turn to, and like. It's an airier subject for me, and I guess one that I, in general, frankly, really like better. I get tired of the computer world.
Well, let's go back. Let's go back and then work our way up to House. I want to ask a few questions about yourself. I don't know that, I don't believe that Houghton Mifflin gave me a press kit or anything. I don't think I have any background material about you other than a little bit of, I know you won the Pulitzer, and I know that your first book was Road to Yuba City, but I don't know very much about you. Are you a native of Massachusetts?
No, I was born in New York City, mm-hmm. and I was raised on Long Island, and then I went away to school and away to college to Harvard, and after Harvard I went to Southeast Asia, and then...
Well, what did you do in Southeast Asia?
I was in the Army. I was in Army Intelligence.
Well, when was this?
Though you might not have noticed the improvement.
Oh, no. Come. Well, what did you study in Harvard?
English. I started out in political science. I had a course with Henry Kissinger, and it bored me. So, Frank, this is really true. I got up in the middle of that course and went over to the English department and switched my major. I had a wonderful professor at Harvard named Robert Fitzgerald, the translator from the Greek and the poet.
Oh, he did the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah, a great man to me.
A poet in his own right.
A good poet, yeah.
Friend of Robert Olds.
I guess so, yeah. He died only recently. I really loved that man. I mean, what a wonderful fellow he was, you know. And he made writing so exciting to me at the age of about 19 or 20. Anyway, he was very important to me. A lot of other important people. After the Army, I came back and sort of hid in my parents' house and wrote a novel about Vietnam, which was subsequently destroyed. But it was important to me because it was a book. I finished the thing. The book seems so long when you've never written one. You know, it still seems kind of long. I went to the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop after that. I wasn't really making any headway in my ambition to be a professional writer. That was a rather nice place for me because they gave me a little sinecure, and my wife taught out there, and I met real writers, you know, and I met a lot of young writers who were just as arrogant and conceited and callow as I was.
Iowa must be a wonderful place because I talked to so many writers from Iowa, from Kurt Vonnegut who taught there, John Irving, and I just can't even remember all the names of everybody who's passed through there.
I think every really notable American poet has passed through there either as a student or as a teacher or both. In fiction, perhaps, it's a little less distinguished, but Flannery O'Connor was a student there. And all the people you've mentioned. And when I was there, the instructors were Vance Borghele and Seymour Krim, who was very important to me. It was Krim who made me realize that you could do in nonfiction, I mean, that you could employ the narrative arts. I mean, you could apply them to nonfiction. And that seemed exciting to me, particularly since I really wanted to be a professional writer and I didn't really want to get hung up in academia. It was perfectly obvious to me that nonfiction was a lot easier to publish than fiction.
When you were growing up here in New York City, did you say?
No, I was born here and I lived here for a few years and then out in Long Island. Then I lived on Long Island when it was still country.
When you were growing up on Long Island, You set out initially, before you got bored with Henry Kissinger, to be a political science major, and you switched to English. But was there something in your upbringing that made you have a literary bent?
My mother, yeah. My great-grandfather was a sort of semi-famous, he was French, sort of semi-famous animal painter. Also, there's an old painting of Buff, was it Buffalo Bill? Anyway, he came to America, and I don't know all of his history. My mother, anyway, went to Barnard and did a lot with the theater and did some writing of her own. And I think she always encouraged me along these lines, you know. It was very nice. So I guess that's the only real explanation, although, you know, I was always read to as a kid, and I always loved books.
After Harvard and after Southeast Asia, I presume it was Southeast Asia.
Yes, Vietnam.
After Iowa, and you wrote a novel about Vietnam, which you say you destroyed. But you did turn out a first book, which was Road to Yuba City. Tell me about that. When was that?
I think memory grows furtive, as A.J. Liebling said, but I think it was 1973 when I published that. That was about a murder case in California, a grisly mass murder. I had had a friend, a photographer friend named Mike Mathers, who was doing a documentary, a book on railroad hobos. And I had tried to do some writing for that. That failed, but when that murder case happened, I realized that some of the sorts of people I'd met, you know, old hobos, the remnants of hobos, had been some of the victims. And so I rode freight trains out to California, something I'd never do now. And I covered the case. I was a... I'm not. It's not a book that I really would like to set back and get back into print now, because it has an awful lot of. It makes me think it's a juvenilia, and I think there's some sort of basic mistakes that I make, but it's got some moments. Maybe someday I'll look at it again.
Are you writing full time, or do you have an honest job?
No honest job. All my friends say I've never worked for a living. I teach one course at Smith College in the spring. Or I have done. I did it last year. I'll do it again this year. But aside from that, I mean, I have no real job. I just write. I've written for the Atlantic Monthly for years and years. And I think that's really where I learned to write, from Bob Manning and my editor, Richard Todd.
Well, you spent months researching Assault of a New Machine with the people at Data General. And it got absolute rave reviews when it came out. And certainly the Pulitzer for non-fiction category.
Yeah.
Certainly it deserved. Were you, this was only your second book, and a young man, were you surprised at all?
Oh, yeah, I was astonished. I mean,
What was it like when you, how did you find out about it, first of all?
The Pulitzer?
Mm-hmm.
The AP called you. Really. And a guy said, I'd been sort of tipped off. I'd had some reason to think that I might be getting one, but I didn't really believe it. I mean, I wanted to believe it. And the guy called. A reporter called and said, "How do you feel?" And I wasn't feeling too good. I just dislocated my shoulder, and I said, "Well, I'm all right. How are you?" And he said, "Oh well," he said, "you haven't heard." And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you just won the Pulitzer." And so then I groped around in my mind for something modest to say, you know, although I wasn't feeling very modest. And then I went, you know, I can't remember the name of the poet. A really fine poet whose line is that when he won the Pulitzer, someone put a glass of wine in his hand and he put it down 48 hours later. It was sort of like that. it kind of knocked me off my feet at first. I mean, I was a little bit shaken by it, believe it or not. I mean, I was so delighted and so excited that I think for some months afterward I didn't behave very well at parties.
Well,
big publishing parties.
You deserved it. You deserve to behave that way, I think, perhaps. It's kind of strange that the Pulitzer... You said you were kind of tipped off, but it's rather strange that you didn't get an official notification. You found out by somebody in the
I think that's media. What happens. And then you get a little later on a check and a sort of diploma from Columbia University.
Not a mailgram.
I think I did get a mailgram, but the AP, you know, I mean, AP's got to get their stories fast. And I guess... I don't know how that all works, but I think it's kind of a nice way to find out
well,
the truth.
Between the time that you wrote The Soul of a New Machine and your new book, House, have you spent most of that period working on House, is that
yeah.
true?
Yeah, well, I had two false starts. I had a project that I badly wanted to do, which was about wilderness, and this was during the time when Watt was Secretary of the Interior, but it just didn't pan out for me. So then I branched off and I did a bunch of articles about atmospheric chemistry, about ozone, and I was looking into the whole range of those, I think, rather interesting issues. But I got worn out on that, too. Then I was going to do a book. I had another idea for a book that didn't pan out. But And I'd wanted to do this from the start. My editor had said, why don't you wait and do something in between? Because as I conceived of this book, it was to be a short, luminous book about carpenters. And he thought that maybe I should try something else for my second book. The pressure that a prize like the Pulitzer puts on you, if you're a young writer and it's come to you so early, is it runs sort of like this. This is the thought that more or less that was in my mind. I certainly don't want to have the critics saying he's a flash in the pan, sophomore slump, you know, the whole sort of thing. I mean, I wanted it to be a good book, and I feel kind of lucky. I mean, it's always taken me when you do one of these books, it takes me 2 to 3 years to do one, and you don't like to go into them lightly. So I'm willing to spend a couple of months or more looking into a project, and I'm willing to abandon it if I can afford to, just to avoid the kind of pain of coming 2 years down the road and realizing this is not going to work.
But you said something that is absolutely true and scary in a way. You just won the Pulitzer Prize for your second book, and a young writer at that. And it's the kind of prize that Vance Bourgeli, for example, would probably love to win as the crowning achievement of his long literary career.
Yeah.
And here you won it so soon. But you have all of these years ahead of you to produce. And it's scary because your next book, will this win the Pulitzer Prize? And it shouldn't necessarily have to win the Pulitzer Prize to be the equal or better. I mean, there are all sorts of flukes, and the judges change year after year. I mean, there are all sorts of things can happen. And yet you worry. You say, can this book be as good? Will this one win the accolades? Mm-hmm. And you're always going to have to live with that legacy for every book you write.
Well, I feel a little bit of weight off me right now, to tell you the truth. This book has been very generously treated by the critics and also by the people who are close to me and, you know, the writers in my circle who are very honest with me, and they do seem to like it. And also there's, you know, yourself to please, and I'm pleased with this one. I mean, I'm in some many ways more pleased with it than with Soul. So in a way I feel, I certainly don't want to write a lousy book next time, but if I feel like I could screw up now or slip a little, and I wouldn't be and consigned to the trash can.
When you began work on House, you had to enlist the cooperation of Jonathan and Judith. Sawain.
Yeah.
And I believe you have a pronouncer in here in the book, and
yeah.
I always keep forgetting how to do it, and it's not too much different from my name, too. Or at least in terms of pronunciation.
Yeah.
But anyway, you had to enlist their cooperation, but it was even more than that. You had to enlist the cooperation of the architect and of the four men who were part of the Apple Corps.
Yeah.
And how much, first of all, were the Sawain's friends of yours? Is that how
no.
you got to know them?
No, the builders had worked for me, had done some work on my house, the Apple Corps, mm-hmm. and I had gotten to know them and liked them, and actually I was really interested in them. And I also had done some amateur carpentry, which, you know, I'm not very good at it, but I really loved it. The whole idea intrigued me. So I came at it from the carpenters, and it took them a long time to agree to do it. And, you know, one of the things you do, I think, you should do as a journalist in this kind of a project where you're not dealing with public figures, is read people their Miranda warnings and tell them, you know, whatever you say may get into this book. And anyway, this job came along, and I asked Jim Locke just to mention to the Sawains who I was and my interest, and so I had lunch with them, told them what I wanted to do, and they agreed to it. There was the only thing I gave away in these sorts of negotiations was that I've made it a policy, I don't know exactly why, never to get a subject in trouble with the IRS, and never to characterize children. The Sawains were concerned about what I might write about their children, I think, you know, who are very young. I was aching sometimes while writing this book to say more about the kids, but I just didn't feel like I could in any case, and I'd said that I wouldn't. Otherwise, they understood, I think, what I was trying to do. Perhaps they didn't understand how deeply I meant to go, how deep I hoped to go. I don't think I certainly didn't want to mislead anyone. As for the architect, he seemed delighted to see me the first time we met at Jim Locke's house. He had read Soul, and he was quite receptive to the whole thing.
Did you have to have some sort of written or contractual agreement with the
publisher? Well, this is a tricky business now in publishing because of all of these, you know, wild libel suits. As a practical matter, those releases don't release you from libel, even if they say they do. But sure, I had releases from all of them. What those releases do is show that you've, you know, really gone ahead in good faith, and I think they protect you to some degree from people claiming that you're invading their privacy or that you snuck up on them in some way. But you're still bound by the libel laws, I think.
Were you faced with the possibility of having one of the participants read the manuscript and object?
Well, there's always that possibility. I did show the finished book to all of them before it was published, partly because I knew Houghton Mifflin was going to produce about 1,500 bound galleys, and I wanted them to read the book and draw their own conclusions before they started to hear about it. But I didn't offer the book to them then for changes. I did it as a courtesy, and that was understood. A couple of people, this is hard to remember, but there were a few little things that were wrong, and I don't mind changing that if they're matters of fact. And I think there were, for a couple of people, a couple of things that to me were of absolutely no significance that they wished weren't there, or they felt weren't really quite right. I don't mind that. No one here, I mean, I like to think of these people as really adults. You know, when it came to me, they dealt very fairly and openly. And I think that the other thing is that they all recognized themselves, I mean, at least parts of themselves in the portrait, and I think they all liked the book. So I didn't have that problem, but you do worry about that.
So you had to make some minor changes, but not any major changes in terms of the book's thrust.
I made almost no changes. I mean, no, absolutely nothing major. To give you an example of the kind of change, Bill Rahn saw a passage in which I had said that he knocked on doors in Amsterdam to get glimpses of Corbusier interiors. Well, I don't know how I'd gotten this wrong, but there are no Corbusier interiors in Amsterdam. There are some in suburban Paris, and that's where he'd done it, suburban Paris and in Alsace. There was a church in Alsace he went to. I mean, that kind of getting that from the subject and just in time to change it in the galleys is a great feeling, because it would have been wrong, and most architectural critics probably would have picked that up. So it was really along those lines that changes were made, and I think, I think there was, actually now, to come to think of it, there was one person in the book who was sort of a peripheral character, but to whom I offered some control. I mean, that is to say, I said, look, I know this could be tremendously painful to you. I won't can do this with anybody else, but, you know, you've agreed to talk to me, but if you can't stand this, we'll have to do something about it. But she passed on it. It was all right.
Well, you did what...
It's a hard... You know, you're really right at the heart of something that really is troubling.
Oh, look, this has happened to me, I don't know how many times, where I've written articles and people have backed out at the last minute, refused to cooperate or threatened a lawsuit, mm-hmm. and the publisher said, I just don't want to go through the hassle, you know, let's just drop it, it's not that big. But it was always big to me, because
yeah,
I was spending days or weeks researching it.
But the other thing, the painful thing is, I mean, if you are a conscientious journalist, and I try to be, you simply cannot allow the people you're writing about to control what you say. I mean, that is just a no-no. And I've never done that, and I hope I never will. But, you know, it's always a question of where do you draw the line, you know. I can remember in the computer book, there was a young man who was really distressed by the fact that I had mentioned that he'd done badly in engineering school. This really hurt him. I don't even know why I was there. It wasn't germane, and it seemed to me the easiest thing in the world to take it out, because it didn't hurt anything to take it out. I mean, I don't want to be rigid and insist on something, on doing something hurtful when it's not important, you know. But if it had been something much more important, like the fact that, in this guy's case, that he had quit the project in the middle, and he didn't want that in there, well, I would have had a problem with that.
Well, you did what you said you wanted to do, and something that you picked up at Iowa, and that is to take a novelized approach to House. You put the book, a nonfiction book, in the present tense. You use dialogue throughout.
Now the dialogue is really accurate. I mean, that's right from my notes. I mean, I didn't put in my book everything that I had in my notes, and you know, some of the dialogue is cut down. But that's exactly what people said, at least as best as I can copy it down, and I take notes real fast.
Well, was this disconcerting to the Swains and Ron and the rest to have you follow them around with a notepad?
From time to time, I think it was. But one of the tricks of this game is you warn everybody about what you're going to do, and you make them scared of you, and then you just hang around and hope that they'll forget that you're there, or become so accustomed to having you there that you really don't become an intrusive presence. Now, I can't pretend that you don't disturb what you're observing in this game, but I do think that the personality and character, given time, is like fingerprints, and that it can't be altered completely. So I don't think that these people were acting in front of me. And when the arguments, which did some, there were some arguments in this over this house building, as there are over any house building, it seems. When those occurred, I had the feeling they just didn't even know I was there. I mean, they were heated, and it was as though I really had vanished. I tried to get over into the corners of the room, at least psychically. Mm-hmm. That took place.
What has happened now that you've finished the book and everybody has read it? Are you still friends with the Apple Corps and the Swains?
Yeah, we all had a nice dinner at a publication party here in New York, and everyone came. Everyone, except for one of the Carpenters. And everyone was quite friendly, I think. It's nice. I mean, that isn't what you write a book for. You don't write a book to please the people you're writing about. You write it to please your editor,
or yourself,
or this mythical creature known as the reader. And yourself. Yeah, sure.
Well, of course, House is the story of a house. The story of the Swain's house from its inception to its completion, and all the people who built it and designed it, and so forth. But it's not just the story of hammers and nails, but the story about the conflicts and the personalities involved. And it moves so fast, and it just flows. And it's certainly a wonderful job. And I'm pleased that I have the opportunity of reading it and talking to you. I guess I should ask you, now that you've finished House, are you just going to take a rest, or are you embarking on still a new project?
Well, I'm doing two things. I'm working on some fiction, which may or may not pan out. I'd like to write fiction. As well as write nonfiction. And I'm also thinking about the next nonfiction project. Right now, one idea that I have the last two books have been about groups of people working, and private people. And I've been thinking that it would be nice to write a book in which one person is at the center, more or less biography, and maybe a public figure, someone I think people might admire, someone like Mario Cuomo, or
mm-hmm.
The problem, of course, with that sort of subject is that it's very hard for people in those kinds of positions to give you the kind of access that you need, and this, the need for me to be in control of what I write, completely in control, is sometimes not negotiable.
Now, I have a feeling someone like Cuomo, at least, is very accessible.
Well, I haven't even.
Might be accessible.
I pull that name out of the air because he's in such an interesting...
Well, it's obvious that you have the credentials to make that approach. Somebody who doesn't have them as you do might find it difficult, but...
There are lots and lots of interesting people out there, of course.
Yeah. You say you're interested in writing fiction. What sort of fiction do you like to read now? Or do you have any...
I'm pretty eclectic. I pull it out of... right now I'm reading a delightful nonfiction book, actually, by Mark Singer called Funny Money. Wonderful book. I like a whole range of fiction of the contemporary writers. I guess Saul Bellow and Updike are a couple of my favorites. I love Peter Matheson .
I have a feeling you probably develop your own voice in terms of fiction in the way that you've done with nonfiction.
Well, I think you have to. I have done some fiction. I published a couple of short stories with The Atlantic. I'm not extremely proud of them, but there they are. And I'm working on one right now that I've been working on for 10 years.
Do you live near Amherst?
Yeah. I live to the west of the Connecticut River, up in the hills, in the beginning, the foothills of the Berkshires. It gets quite heavily wooded up there. On the way toward these Carpenters, Apple Valley.
It gets cold, too.
It gets a bit chilly.
How do you have your working space set up?
I've got a little office in my house, and I have I borrow offices sometimes. For this book, I borrowed Smith gave me an office. I borrowed an office from a music teacher at Smith for the summer once, for one summer, and then I had a little tiny office that, as a friend of mine said, smelled like a old New York City cab in the basement of the library. And I was the troll of the Smith College Library. I'd emerge, you know, unshaven, and wander, pace up and down the stairs.
You have a family?
Yeah.
Children?
Yeah, a couple.
Do they get away from you to give you some breathing space so you can concentrate on what you're doing?
Well, they're both in school now, and my wife's a painter, and we kind of split things up, although I'd say she's probably taken the heavier load. And the kids, we get the kids off to school in the morning, and then there's some hours. You know?
How do the kids explain what Daddy does? My daddy doesn't do anything. He just writes books.
Well, I guess, I don't know that, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to know exactly what sorts of problems they have along those lines. I think they've been more along the lines of, in our little town, of, your daddy's famous, he must have made $10 million on this last book, if only it were true. But I don't think it's, I hope it's not too big a problem. They seem to be amused more than anything.
How old are they?
11 and 6.
Well, the 11-year-old at least can read it, or has he read it, or she?
He hasn't read it. Maybe someday. I don't want to force it on him at all. I showed him the New York Times book review. You know, I got such a lovely cover review on this, and he read the first paragraph and he said, "Well, Dad, looks like they liked it."
Yeah, I'll have to read this someday. Well, Tracy Kitty, you're certainly easy to talk to, and your writing is marvelous, and certainly have another winner here. I appreciate very much you taking the time out of a schedule. It's probably filled with interviews and things to come and talk to me.
This is a nice one, though. Nice and restful. Thank you.